Luckily for you, the answer to the great question of life, the universe and everything is to be found in this podcast, A Worker's Guide to Everything. Sometimes cans, often bad language, always solid politics. This is the Trademark Belfast podcast. Listen out for Trademark regulars and very special comrade guests and fellow travellers talking all things lefty, Ireland and the world. We remain, as always, anti-sectarian, anti-racist and anti-fascist. Enjoy. Buenig soltas.
Hello and welcome once again to the first Trademark podcast of the new year, 2024. Shaping up to be a shit year by the look of it. We're going to talk about political economy of 2024. I'm joined again by comrade Stuart Law and Sean Byers. We're going to look at current trends in geopolitics in China, maybe look at the European economy, also known as what the fuck is Germany up to. We're going to look at the IRA, the American one, and of course, we can't not mention the genocide that's ongoing in Gaza, and perhaps we'll look at some of the political, geopolitical dynamics of that that situation, what's going on over there. I want to thank all our guests over the last year, by the way, in 2023, for coming on our podcast, and these two in particular, Stuart, I want to give a big thank to, because Stuart stepped in over a couple of years ago into the shoes of Mel Corry, whose voice and analysis you can hear on earlier pods. We remember Mel's passing 3 years ago this month from COVID. Any passing conspiracy theorists listening can go fuck yourself. So thanks very much, Stuart, for that, for coming in. Your presence, your analysis is most welcome. These podcasts, of course, in our own little way, continue to be an attempt to apply some sort of critical analysis to the very strange world we're living in, and particularly a critical perspective on, I suppose, capitalism and imperialism, on issues of exploitation, of inequality, and not least class struggle. And we hope that it encourages those listening to a deeper analysis of the underlying structures and the dynamics of capitalism. And of course, we do that because we believe that understanding the contradictions within this system helps us kind of identify maybe potential for social change. That's what it's all about at the end of the day. And for radical social transformation, more equitable and more just society, and indeed a livable planet. So that's the intros done. Lads, thanks for coming on this week. First off, we're going to kick off with a little warmer question. It's something that I asked the lads over the weekend to bung out some articles or some themes they wanted to talk to. It's going to be quite informal, quite free form. But this first one's an interesting one. It brings in a few themes and starts to link things together. And it highlights the importance, of course, of political economy and understanding what the fuck's going on in the world. And there is an article you threw up, Stuart, which I thought was really interesting, which is this idea of demographic shift, particularly in the global north, if you like, in the minority world, and labor shortages, and what that tells us about what's going on in the world and what that might predict for the next 10, 20 years. So over to you first, Stuart, for that one. It was an article referring to labour shortages, particularly in Japan and in its tourist season. So over to you, mate.
First of all, I have to ask, who the fuck is Stuart Law, as you introduced me?
You know who Stuart Law is? That's me thinking of Joe Law, which is another one of our comrades who fucking died 8 years ago now. So apologies for that. That's a great compliment. To be, a great compliment, by the way, calling you Stuart Law.
I was just thinking, that's right. I've got a bit of a Dennis Law accent, but being compared to both Dennis and Joe, I'm pretty damn proud of. I think about the population crisis, and it is a crisis in many places, and demographics in general is something that we tend to neglect. So I'm very glad we're talking about this, to be honest. When you look, you asked here, what does this say about the global economy? The paradigm I see very broadly, and this is a bit of a simplification, is you have an aging population with dough in the global north, and they're spending a lot of money on importing care workers to take care of them from the global south. I saw something this morning. Africa has 25% of the world's diseases, but 3% of the care workers in the planet, because so many come here. About 20%, I think, of EU, people that come to the EU are care workers, similar in the United States. And when you look at some of the figures, you can understand this. And I saw that in Italy in 2022, there were only 392,000 births with a population the size of that. And I saw something that's going to be even lower in 2023. And I saw something which was vaguely comical, albeit a little bit repulsive, about Japan yesterday. There's a big increase, as you know, in the number of old people in the Japanese population. And that's given us a concomitant increase in what they call silver porn. you have people in their 60s through to the 80s appearing in the porn industry. And when you look at the figures here, I think there was something like...
Well, I don't want to have to check your hard drive anytime soon, Stuart.
And it does give you some interesting search results. Well, I, of course, applied for a job here, but a bit like when I applied to Hezbollah, I failed in medical. Anyway, when you look here, the number of 18-year-olds in Japan, 1.06 million. An estimated 36.2 million people, 65 or older. Now, the Japanese have had this demographic crisis for a couple of generations. Similar will happen in China and similar will happen here. And I think the paradigm is that people think they'll all come from Africa. We'll get Africans coming across here, but for various reasons, that is not going to work. And also, you have to remember, too, that if you're a proper globalist and internationalist, it screws people. I mean, remittances that people who come to the global north earn and send back to the developing world are good, but it still takes away the people, particularly the young people. So we have to think here and the wider picture. What sort of planet do we want to live in and what are our priorities?
Yeah, really interesting, Sean. It is a fascinating topic, demographics. We haven't actually spoken about it very much in this podcast. It's maybe something that we should actually, Stuart, look into in a bit more depth because, of course, it's a favourite theme of the right, particularly the eco-fascist right, who talk about overpopulation, there were too many people on the planet. And, you know, it's kind of a myth there. It's one of their conspiracy myths, isn't it? Also about in Ireland, they're calling it the second plantation, is the kind of far-right myth around a mass immigration. But mass immigration, if you like, is an issue to be talked about. And the left can't really talk about it very well. And we have to discuss it, don't we, in the terms of the political economy of the global economy, Sean, because there are push and pull factors on immigration. And Stuart's just outlined a few of them there for us.
Yeah, it's very difficult to talk about this subject without risking inflating like anxieties around migration and so on. I suppose worth mentioning, there's a couple of more short-term post-COVID sort of factors that are compounding the challenge that Stuart's talking about. So first of all, I'm sure people have heard of the Great Resignation. They call it where tens of millions of people chose to quit their jobs in mainly low-paid, precarious sectors characterized by like unfair treatment, hospitality and retail are the big ones. There's also been a big drop in average hours worked by full-time workers since COVID, which is a combination of increase in long-term sickness. That's another thing that we'll maybe get back to. It's been a huge explosion in long-term sickness since COVID in particular. And also people just choosing to work shorter hours for a better work-life balance. So these factors combined with the demographic trends that Stuart talks about are going to be a major challenge. And the capitalist solutions are becoming more grim and dystopian, right? So we're seeing attempts across the global north to increase the retirement age and force people to work into their 70s. A number of American states have gone a step further in legalizing child labor. Migration is another proposed or it's viewed as another solution, which obviously leads to exploitation on an industrial scale. And there's a discourse that has even crept into left-wing, so-called left-wing narratives, the idea that we should encourage inward migration, not for a moral reason or because it's the right thing to do, but because migrants are willing to do shitty jobs for fuck all, you know? So we need to start thinking of having these conversations, thinking about these questions and trying to think about socialist responses and solutions to them.
Absolutely. I think to give him his second plug of the podcast, it's what Gramsci might have called an organic crisis in capitalism. You know, it's not just a periodic downturn, is it? These are serious cracks appearing in nearly every edifice of capitalist society and economics. And capital, you know, it's losing its ability to claim to be the ruling universal interest of the planet because it can't cope with its own contradictions anymore, I think. I mean, obviously, that's one of the reasons for the rise of fascism and for the rise of anti-immigrant sentiment and for the rise of the right globally, I suppose. But, the fact we're looking into, you know, secular stagnation and climate breakdown, yeah, shaping up to be an interesting decade, say the least. Stuart, you want to pop in there? Come on.
Yeah, I just want to recommend very quickly a very good little book I read a while ago by a Dutch guy. I forget what the guy's name is, but here we go. Yes, it's How Migration Really Works by Hein de Haas. He makes the point very clearly in a very typical blunt Dutch way. It's driven by demand for labour. The vast majority of people who arrive in the global north do so legally. There was a Pew study a while ago, I think last week or maybe the week before, something like 45% of Brits believe that most people in the country arrived illegally or irregularly. It's about 4%. That applies everywhere. And this is the bigger issue because we talked about this briefly before. We have a system which is crabsing, run by predatory bastards, but people are going to be blaming the blacks and the immigrants rather than they're blaming capitalism. So this is why the work we do is important. It's a matter of getting the message out there clearly and in the language people can relate to and understand.
Yeah, I think we might return to that issue, lads. I think a podcast or a couple on migration and immigration within capitalism would be really interesting and really useful. Look, moving on, in terms of what the lads have suggested we talk about, of course, you cannot talk about the political economy of 2024 without talking about China and things that are happening in China. Very interesting. We've been watching them over the last couple of years. We've spoken a lot in our podcast about, you know, the finance, insurance and real estate sector, or FIRE, as we call it. That kind of is kind of the modern finance capitalist successor to Europe's kind of post-feudal landed aristocracy, i.e. the people who make money and who live by extracting profits through land rents. And you know that. You know how far China's integrated into the modern capitalist economy when it's having its own crises within its own property market and within its own very large shadow banking sector. I'll come to you first, Stuart, again, just because we did look last year at Evergrande. We talked about it on a number of occasions, which is a massive property developed, massive corporation in China, which has something in the region of $300 billion worth of debt. And I understand it's just been liquidated. So tell us a little bit, what does that mean, Stuart, for the Chinese economy? Or does China and the CCP have the ability to control that, to bail it out, to deal with that situation?
I think it truly shows that China is now part of the capitalist world, because whenever you have a property crisis and a related shadow banking crisis, you know that's where you are. It was interesting that the response today across the stock markets in Asia, including the Chinese markets, was relatively muted. I think this had been discounted before. I think people expected it. I think the consensus is that this will continue to have a downwards impact on consumption, which will obviously affect the Chinese economy and that of Germany as well, but we'll come on to that later, rather than be catastrophic. I think we need to talk about the scale here. Apparently, China's shadow banking sector is, according to some estimates, now it's difficult to get these estimates accurate, it's $3 trillion. $3 trillion. You know, this is fucking huge, man. The property crisis is huge, too. When you look at the situation in the stock market I talked about earlier, $6 trillion has been wiped off the Chinese and Hong Kong stock market since the most recent peak 3 years ago. So this is serious. Now, they've introduced some laws recently to stop people short selling stocks, basically selling stocks that you don't have any expectation that you will go down. And I think that has calmed the market to a certain extent, or the markets. And the general belief is that there is a fundamental strength still in the Chinese economy. The Chinese government will back up those they need to back up, and things will recover. I saw something in Fidelity International a couple of days ago saying Chinese stocks are really cheap. This is time to buy. If I were invested in this sort of thing, I'd buy Chinese stocks now, because there is some real strength there in the market. China's expected to grow by about 5% or more in 2024. And the electronic vehicle market is doing fantastic. Now, we might talk about this a bit later when we talk about Germany, because this is screwing the Germans right now. So China has major issues. Getting back to demographics, the long-term problem they have is the population is aging and is dying. In a generation's time, they'll have the same issues there that we're talking about in Japan.
Interesting stuff, Sean. It seems that a lot of the information, certainly that I read about China, comes via Western media, and it's always doom and gloom, and China's about to fall through the floor, and it's about to collapse, and Chinese capitalism is not to be trusted, and it's unstable. But listen to Stuart there. It seems as if China has the levers and the ability to control whatever crises that obviously the own internal contradictions of capitalism creates in China. Would that be fair? I mean, is Chinese Keynesianism still strong enough to cope with all of these contradictions?
Well, look, there's no doubt that this is like an unprecedented challenge that the Chinese state is facing in terms of its development over the last 40 years. Like, the real estate sector accounts for 30% of GDP in the Chinese economy, like compared to 15% in the US. And the US real estate sector is massive. So a property collapse is going to have massive ripple effects on the wider Chinese economy. Even without a financial crisis, it's going to take the government years to dismantle Evergrande, which I think is what will happen more likely than a liquidation. I don't think the Chinese state will allow for just a liquidation on of the type that's being proposed. I think they'll dismantle it in a managed sort of fashion. They'll look to try to unwind the effects of property speculation and wean the economy off its reliance on that sector, which is going to be really difficult. There's as many as 70% of the Chinese population whose wealth and futures are wrapped up in property. So it's going to be really difficult to deal with that. But as Stuart says, China has strong foundations for working its way through these problems. There's a good piece by Michael Roberts on this. Like, so he points out, like, despite all the gloomy forecasts, all the naysaying, all, you know, the doom and gloom that's coming out of the Western media, the Chinese economy still grew by 5.2% last year, which is like much higher rate than every major economy except US and India. He also notes that the Chinese state has massively increased its investment and spending to compensate for some of the decline in non-productive sectors like finance and real estate, which reminds us of like China's unrivaled ability and willingness to intervene. So like, I wouldn't bet, and on top of that, China remains the world's sole manufacturing giant. It leads the way in green, we'll talk a wee bit more about this later maybe, leads the way in green technology and renewables, controls a large proportion of critical raw materials. So I wouldn't bet against them managing to ride this one out and to come out stronger on the other side of it.
Yeah, thanks for that.
Michael Roberts talked about the sorry, I wonder if Michael Roberts talked about the falling rate of profit in the China economy.
He may have touched on that particular issue. Yeah, maybe we should just do a full podcast on Michael and his own obsession with his with the falling rate of profit. Talking about the falling rate of profit, and you mentioned already about China, Sean, kind of being strong enough to withstand any crises or multiple crises that go through in the short term, at least. But it kind of feeds into this debate that's been going on for the last year and a half, at least since post-COVID, about deglobalization and about protectionism and about, you know, national industrial strategies and people pulling back, if you like. Now, we've seen that, particularly in the United States, with their fear of being over-reliant on the supply chains that come through places like China. So they want to be independent of those supply chains. And I suppose that links us back, Stuart, to the IRA, to the in the United States. Tell us very briefly what the IRA is, and then go on to tell us, like, it's a huge attempt by the United States to spend back into its own economy, isn't it? I mean, I read the other day that it was going to cost something like $385 billion over 10 years. And that's a massive spend that they're directing back into the Yank economy. Why are they doing it? What is the IRA, and why are the Yanks doing it?
It's basically an attempt to freeze China out of the world economy and to take on China, which tends to be the global leader in many areas of the green renewables. And the cost, some people have said lately, the cost could be as high as $6 trillion. It is fucking huge. I mean, this is an incredible, huge industrial strategy from the States. You have to take your hat off to the boldness. It's basically subsidizing people in America and people that come to America, which again has an impact on the Germans we'll talk about, to produce goods there and to reduce reliance upon China. It's interesting in that the Inflation Reduction Act, largely due to Mr. Senator Joe Manchin, did get support from the fossil fuels industry because the impact on them will not be great. They got quite a few concessions in there. So don't think this is anything which is going to save the world economy. Far from it. So an attempt by the States to screw China, which is having an impact on other European economies, particularly Germany. And the cost is massive. There was something in the FT last week about could European countries reproduce this? No. On an individual basis, probably in the European Union too, impossible to reproduce. And remember, a lot of this is predicated on the power of the dollar, because there will be a massive increase in US government deficits after this, but nobody is going to stop buying US Treasury bills.
Yeah, we did talk about the BRICS and the replacement of the dollar as the world reserve. I don't think anyone thinks realistic that's going to happen anytime soon. You were certainly very strong on that issue, Stuart. I think it's just kind of a hope for some people they might see the collapse of the US empire. That's not going to happen anytime soon. Sean, it's interesting, isn't it? This concept of de-globalization and bringing supply chains back, or shortening supply chains so that people aren't at risk, if you like, so the states aren't at risk from losing out. But when you look to Europe, we'll talk about Germany in a minute, but let's talk about Britain just very briefly, because some of our listeners are over there. It's really interesting, isn't it, that Europe, particularly Britain, has absolutely no equivalent of the Inflation Reduction. It has absolutely no equivalent of any idea of an actual industrial strategy, let alone a green industrial strategy, when everyone else in the world is thinking in those terms, but Britain isn't. What's going wrong there?
Well, just to begin with, like, I just want to be a bit of a contrarian on this, if only to challenge the stereotype of our podcast being three lads agreeing with each other. You know, the IRA is significant, but I was looking under the hood, and it's not phenomenal. Like, if you put the limits of capitalist growth to one side for a minute, you would say that the US and the EU both need something on the level of Roosevelt's New Deal or the Marshall Plan or the kind of intervention you saw during COVID to bring about a green and economic revolution. The IRA falls well short of this. Even if the 1 trillion figure is to be believed, this is over the course of a decade and only amounts to about 0.4% of GDP per year, right? And that pales in comparison to the support provided to the fossil fuel sector. I know we're not the trust economists, but the future impact of Biden's plan has been modelled, and the total impact on growth is not expected to amount to more than a fraction of a percent of GDP. There are predictions of 900,000 jobs created in clean energy and tech sectors, which is pretty welcome, but that's also quite small spread over a decade. And there's a lot of evidence to date that these are good jobs, well-paying jobs, unionised jobs.
It doesn't matter that Britain doesn't have an industrial strategy then, because it wouldn't be worth fuck all anyway.
But, well, the point is, like, what Stuart has said is that it seems like such a dramatic intervention, because it is, relative to what the EU and the likes of Britain are doing. The EU's green industrial plan, like, pales in fucking comparison to what the US is doing. There's no prospect of them massively scaling up those plans either. Britain has the industrial strategy is non-existent in Britain, and it has been for some time. Labour's alternative to the Tory government's non-existent industrial plan was a so-called $28 billion plan for a green industrial revolution. Slowly but surely, that's been whittled away. It's been exposed as just an exercise in de-risking, providing unconditional support to the private sector. And now even the Labour Party's saying that if they were in government, they would only deliver on that plan to the extent that their fiscal rules would permit them. In other words, it's not going to fucking happen. So it's not as transformative or as dramatic as it appears, but it's much more than what's being done in Europe or in Britain.
Perhaps it's the geopolitical nature of the IRA that's more significant, in the sense that this is a signal, as Stuart said, to cut China out of markets, to cut China out of supply chains, and to de-globalize. Maybe that's the long-term strategy, is more of a political one than it is economic initially. I wanted to move on, Stuart, because you mentioned Sean's point about the relative sizes of economies and what America's doing relative to the EU. And at the heart of the EU, the engine at the heart of the European Union, was always the German economy. And you put up an article there by Michael Hudson, which I read, which is really interesting. And the title of it, cheekily, was America Defeats Germany for the Third Time in a Century. What does he mean by that? Very briefly, tell us what's America done that's fucked the German economy, and what does that mean really for the EU economy, particularly in the we're in the mouth of an EU election, right? Things are getting worse in the EU in regards to all of the social indices, in terms of inequality, in terms of job creation, in terms of all the rest of it. And we know that the far right is going to be taking power in a number of European states in the European, well, national election, but also in the EU. So what have the Yanks done to Germany?
First of all, I want to aggressively agree with Sean to go ahead and confirm the stereotype. I don't think the IRA will make a huge amount of difference to saving the global economy. It will, however, fuck people, certain people, including the Germans. Basically, what your man was saying in the article was that we had the defeat of Germany by America in 1914. We had the defeat in 1945, though, of course, we know that was a victory for the Soviet Union. And now what they've done is Shaft Germany. And you have to remember, the guy has a point here, because the Americans have long been concerned about the Germans and Russians forming a good, solid relationship. Whenever the Russians showed signs of interest in joining NATO, shortly after the collapse of the Soviet Union, they were told to fuck off because they don't like the idea of a German and Russian military and economic alliance, because that would be very powerful. So what they've done now with provoking the Ukraine war is make Germany significantly reliant on American LNG. We'll talk about this a bit later in terms of the environmental implications. But America didn't used to export any natural gas at all, or any form of gas, in 2016. Now it's the world's biggest exporter. And that's largely because the Germans, a massive industrial power, are having to import that stuff. They're building a couple of massive fucking plants in the Netherlands and Germany to take this stuff in. They're paying a huge amount more for that than Americans are paying, and they're paying a lot more than they paid for the gas beforehand. So Germany here has been shafted. The worst performing economy, major economy, in 2023, and forecast to be the same basket case in 2024. The thing you have to remember about the German economy is it's heavily industrial based. So things like increases in interest rates, because industrial companies generate a lot of working capital requirements, particularly those that buy stuff from overseas to export, that will shaft the Germans a lot more than it will, say, an economy like ours, which is more service-based. So that's how the Americans have shafted the Germans.
What does it say, Sean, for wider Europe and for the European economy, that the biggest economy in Europe's in trouble?
Yeah, well, Germany, for decades, Germany has been the economic and political hegemon of Europe. It's widely viewed as a standout success story of European integration. Although, of course, that success was largely built on the defeat of the German labour movement and the suppression of wages in the early 2000s, which gave Germany...
And 2 million guest workers.
Yeah, which gave Germany a competitive advantage over other members of the Eurozone, and then allowed it to consistently export more than import it. But Germany has, as well as being shafted by the US, the Germany has shafted itself in a number of different ways. First, by putting all of its eggs into that low-wage export, high-export sort of basket. The problems that they're facing now within industry as a result of the higher energy prices, they're unable to compensate for that in household spending, precisely because wages are so low and people have been hit so hard by the cost of living crisis. They've shafted themselves in another way. Since the 1990s, the German government has consistently failed to invest in infrastructure, education, research and development. So whilst Germany and the EU as a whole was pursuing vicious austerity in the wake of the financial crash, the Chinese state, for example, was invested hundreds of billions in all of those things. Right. So the result is that China is miles ahead in the production of cheap electric cars and the development of new green industries. And it gets worse. Germany's own constitutional court has just struck down 60 billion euro worth of planned climate spending due to a homegrown policy, a homegrown insertion in the constitution that limits public deficit to 0.3% of GDP. There's also the prospect of austerity 2.0 coming down the line right across the Eurozone. And Germany's one of those pushing for the reimposition of strict fiscal rules. So it's a US-imposed, but also a self-made disaster that's coming down the line. And meanwhile, in Germany, the AfD is on 22% in the polls and growing.
I was about to say that the result of all of that is a huge rise in support for the AfD, particularly from former East Germany, of course. But I know there were huge demonstrations in Germany last week. I don't want to get into the contradictions of massive demonstrations against the AfD while supporting Israel's genocide in Gaza. But look, it doesn't look good for Europe, and it doesn't look good for Germany. It doesn't look good for the Eurozone either, because as I said before, there are right-wing, quasi-fascist governments in a number of European countries, and the right is on the march across Europe. And Europe's response to that is to ignore the reasons for the rise of the right, to ignore the failures of the European project itself and what it's created, and looking elsewhere and in the wrong places for the trying to understand why the right is on the rise. Stuart, you wanted to pop in there.
It's interesting. Chinese exports to America have collapsed. They've fallen by something like 20%. And when you look at the EV market, the Chinese overinvested in that. They have got massive excess capacity. So what they've done is sell to Europe, particularly Germany. And the Germans, Sean's quite right. Since the early part of the century, they've been wage dumping the rest of Europe. And not just the South. I mean, the Belgians and the French complained about German wage dumping for fucking years. Germany did nothing about it. This, again, is a problem with the euro. The euro doesn't allow any exchange rate adjustment. So in the old days, Germans, the price of the Deutschmark would have gone up. There'd been an adjustment. This is why the Germans were so keen to push the fucking euro. But that's another issue. But what's happened is now the German car industry has been massively undercut by cheap Chinese EVs coming in. So it is quite entertaining that Schadenfreude is a German word. When you look at the growth of the AFD, it tends to be in industrial areas that require massive decarbonization. And this might take it onto a discussion about the environment, because these are the areas that need to change. And they need to change pretty rapidly if we're going to change the environment. That will, in the short term and probably in the medium to long term too, shaft people, and they'll be more inclined to turn to the right.
Yeah, well, the last question will be on the environment, just moving it forward slightly, because I wanted to talk again about, we talked briefly about the influence of the American oil and gas lobbies and industries over, you know, US domestic and indeed foreign policy. It's kind of has a large, if like, oligarchic influence, doesn't it, over American politics. But the other oligarchic influence we need to talk about, of course, is the military industrial complex, arms manufacturers like Raytheon and Boeing and Lockheed Martin, who employ people in nearly every state in the US, which is, of course, why it has massive influence over, you know, Congress and so on, because 2.5 to 3 million people, including supply chains, were employed in that industry. And so it's a huge, important industry with relatively well-paying jobs in kind of technological manufacturing sectors like that. So it's an influential lobby domestically as well as internationally. And of course, I was reading the other day that $75 billion in aid that's gone from the US to fight the war in Ukraine has gone to Ukraine. But 90% of that $75 billion basically stays in the US because it's buying US arms manufacturers. So the war in Ukraine is supporting the military-industrial complex domestically in the US. The other issue we need to talk about, which is linked to the military-industrial complex, of course, linked to Western imperialism, of course, the genocide that's ongoing in Palestine, and particularly in Gaza, of course. And I know there's hundreds of podcasts better than us placed to delve into the depths of this, but perhaps we could think briefly about what's the political economy aspect of this? What's the economic imperatives behind Western support for, you know, the Zionist state, for the Israeli state? And what does that tell us, Sean, about the future of Palestine as well? I got you first, Sean.
Yeah, I haven't really got a fully thought out view on this.
Or maybe I should go to Stuart first, then you can copy what he said.
Look, obviously there's historical and ideological factors that are quite easy to explain. You know, the state of Israel is a European settler colonial project that has come to be part of the West, particularly in the context of rampant Islamophobia and the end of unipolarity. So there's a circling of the wagons in that sense, in terms of the West protecting Israel. The military-industrial complex, of course, benefits from continued arms sales to Israel. And then there's, from a geopolitical perspective, the straightforward go-to explanation for the West's continued defense and support for Israel is that it's a vassal state of the US. It's one that protects the West's interests in the Middle East. It represents a counterweight to the power of the Arab states by virtue of being a nuclear power. And that analysis continues to hold, but like I think only so much. You only explain so much, right? Mm-hmm. So it has to be remembered that before Hamas's operation on the 7th of October, the Biden administration was in the process of trying to build new alliances in the Middle East, repairing relationships with Iran, and trying to build relationships between the Saudis and the Israelis. So Hamas's operation like totally shot all over that. So what is the West's geopolitical interest? By arming and publicly supporting the ongoing genocide in Palestine, you know, Biden is not only guaranteed that he'll lose the next election, but he's fundamentally eroded the moral authority of the West in the eyes of the global South. He's weakened the position of the US more generally in the Middle East and globally. And he's helping to accelerate the realignment of the global order towards multi-regional alliances and away from the power of the US. I would say that US and EU policy on Israel today isn't necessarily one that continues to serve their economic or geopolitical interests. It looks increasingly irrational. Looks increasingly a symptom of a declining American empire lashing out, as it was.
It kind of feels increasingly more like they've lost control of their pit bull, you know, and they can't get it back on the chain. And that's doing serious damage, as you said, to the Western imperialist interests. It's like someone said to me, oh, is Israel really worth it for them anymore? And that's the issue. Is it really worth it for them? I mean, at one point, someone declared, I can't remember who it was, they said that Israel was like a US aircraft carrier in the middle of the Middle East in terms of its military power and imperial power. But it doesn't feel like that anymore, does it, Stuart? I mean, it seems as if they've fucked up here.
I think there's an intellectual, emotional, and kind of financial capture of the Western mind, particularly the American mind, by the Israeli lobby. Meir Shimer's book, I think about 2005, 2006, about the lobby, said that the relationship does America damage. You remember the 1991 war? Saddam tried to get Israeli involved in that war by putting the Scud missiles onto them. Because if Israel became involved in the war, the Arab coalition that was helping America would fall apart. And when you look at the amount of money that America gives to Israel, who do you think is the second biggest recipient of American military aid? It's Egypt, to keep them happy about the situation with Israel. They have a good relationship with the Egyptians. They have a good relationship with most of the Gulf states and with Saudi. They do not need Israel there. But the lobby is very important and very powerful. Any American politician, Christ, as we know here, any British politician that goes against Israel gets hammered by the lobby. They have a lot of money in the States in particular, and that can affect any politician like Hillary Clinton, who dares to voice support, albeit guarded, for the Palestinians. So I think that, Sean's quite right to question this. I think it's irrational. Whenever I was in charge of a martial arts organization, we had a branch in the States. And it was during one ritual slaughter the Israelis were undertaking in Gaza, where I referred to them as a bunch of hideous, pitiless cunts, a phrase which I stand by still. And the guy who headed up the organization got, well, my representative in Wisconsin got in touch saying, you can't keep on doing this because it's affecting my students. They get really upset whenever you criticize Israel this way. Thinking, one, it's a martial art, not a political system, so I can say what the fuck I want. But it was striking how, and this was a mix of, you know, mix of Americans. It wasn't just white Midwestern people. There were Russian Americans there, a whole range of people who were upset that I dared to criticize Israel and it endangered the guy's business there. There's a real emotional connection that is beyond rational. America would be better off, as would the West, just dropping the bastards.
Yeah, well, and we'll maybe come back to that issue there. It's a really interesting one for those listening. Of course, anything you do to help Palestine, to call for a ceasefire, continue going on your marches. Continue, as I said before, on social media, liking and sharing all the posts that you see. There's a huge online battle as well as in the real world, of course, about making sure that Palestinian voices are heard globally. Let's keep at that. Lads, thanks. So the last question, we've got a little bit of time, so don't go on too long. I suppose 2024, it's the year of El Nino. We're going to see an increase in destructive and unpredictable weather patterns. So let's finish with a brief reference to the environment. I'm doing a podcast in a couple of weeks with a few mates of mine here in Ireland. And it's titled The Coming Storm. And it's going to be a little bit apocalyptic. I hope you enjoy it. But what do we think about the environment? How much concern should there be for us over the next few years, 5 to 10 years? And are we going to see things heating up in ways that human kind can't respond to? I mean, we're talking already about mitigations because we've just accepted there's going to be massive changes to the way we live in this world. So is that where we are, Sean? Are we on that road to talk about just mitigation rather than prevention of climate breakdown and the world heating up?
Yeah, I think the past couple of years have provided us with a glimpse of the future. Like all the major climate records you can think of have been broken. Record high temperatures, average global temperature 1.48 degrees last year. Concentration of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, record high sea levels, record low ice levels. And it's the effects of it are playing out before our eyes, especially in the form of extreme weather events, as you said. Like, so you think of the devastating floods in Libya and Pakistan, the droughts in Latin America and the Horn of Africa, the severe heat waves that hit North Africa and Southern Europe, the wildfires in Turkey, Canada, And even fucking Scandinavia was on fire last year. That tells you, gives you a sense.
Colombia's on fire at the moment as well, by the way.
Yeah. And the cost is hundreds of thousands dead, millions more displaced, particularly in low-income countries, but also increasingly in Europe. I think there's 62,000 people died from the heat in Europe in 2022. There's a lot of people think that we're underestimating the level of heat-related deaths. Like, so it's not looking good. We're on track to breach 1.5 degrees at least once by 2027, and then that'll become the long-term average temperature by the mid-2030s. So it's not looking good. I'm not optimistic. There's still a small chance of keeping global warming under 1.5 degrees, but that would require unprecedented action of the kind that we're just not seeing. With the exception of China, China's leading the way in terms of investment in the green transition, but we're not seeing the urgency of action anywhere else.
No, we're not at all. Stuart, last word to you. What do you think? What's we concerned about in terms of the environment this year and moving into 2025?
I sent you guys something this morning about the activist investors who contacted BP and said basically, quit all this green stuff, stick to the knitting, drill, get some more oil out of there. There's been a big collapse in the number of funds launched with environmental priorities over the last 6 months. That will continue. We talk about China doing a good job, but at the same time, remember, China and India are major users of coal. And India in particular projects a massive increase in coal use. I think we lost 4.1 million hectares of land in 2022, a 10% increase from 2021. That will continue next year. We can't go on the way we are. We have to find a way, because the American approach, the European approach in general, has been very competitive. Let's undercut the Chinese. Let's take them on. We need some cooperation. If you buy solar panels, you will get them almost certainly from China. They're incredibly cheap from there because they're made with relatively cheap Chinese labor and very cheap Chinese coal. Modi's a prick, don't get me wrong, but Modi does make the point that if they want the global south to develop, they're going to have to use coal. They're going to have to do something to wean them away from coal if they want to develop in a way which is environmentally friendly, and that will require the global north to subsidize them or to assist them in so doing. The competitive capitalist model isn't going to work. We also have to get away from the religion of growth. If we go for world growth of, say, 3% per annum, which people talk about as being an acceptable level, we double world GDP in about 25 years. And I think even if we are more green, we can't afford to do that. Everyone talks about EVs and these lithium fucking batteries. The impact that has on the countries, the water table, because it takes something like 2 million tons of water to make a ton of lithium. This is a major environmental impact as well on people that might not matter to us in the global north, but it still contributes to a global collapse. And that means more migration, etc. So a big integrated approach, key thing, get away from the religion of growth.
Yeah, maybe another podcast on the concept of growth and on GDP as well is an interesting one to do in terms of economics. It's quite clear that in public discourse, we're not even having the right conversations, let alone implementing the right policies yet, because we're still talking about GDP growth, 3% a year and all the rest of it. So, it's not looking very good for 2024. I hope all of you that, joined up to listening to this aren't too depressed by that. But it's quite clear that unless things change rapidly, I would say, Sean, that we've gone past 2 degrees. I think that's baked in. I think 2 degrees warm and above pre-industrial levels is baked in. And even with current pledges, we're heading for 2.5. And with current activity, we're heading for 4 degrees by the end of the century, which, of course, means the end of human civilization on the planet. So happy new year to everyone. Hope you enjoyed that doom-laden end to this excellent podcast with the lads. Please feel free to go to leftblock.ie and listen to the other 4 podcasts that are on this podcast platform. The Week at Work, which is a kind of an Irish current affairs and political program. The ABCs of Green Politics, which looks at all of those environmental issues in a lot of depth and is very good. Nuala na n'Eol, which is an Irish language podcast by young people looking at issues in Ireland. And of course, North, which is a new podcast by Steve Baker, a mate of ours from the University of Ulster, looking at the relationships between the people on this island and the future, indeed, of this island. So thanks very much for listening, and we'll see you again very soon. Slán go fóill.
That, comrades, was Trademark Belfast. Thanks so much for listening in. We'll see you soon, either in the trenches or on the victory parade. Up the workers and Slán go Fóill.